Welcome to our first live Q&A session of the day. Dr. Julia White will now moderate the questions that came in for the breasts, lymphomas, and palliative care sessions.
We'll start off with the breast section, and we'll try to do this for several minutes and move on to the lymphoma and palliative care sections. I'm going to try to group some of the breast questions together. The one that I found, lots of questions regarding DCIS margin. I do use the 2 millimeter margin that came out with the SSO-ESTRO guideline. I think when you do have a mixed invasive in DCIS patient, we have to be mindful of the, if the invasive margin is negative, but the DCIS margin is positive, you should still try to use the 2 millimeters for the DCIS. You do not want to go forward with that. The other questions people ask is about what DCIS margin do I use for observation? In both the ECOG 5194 and in the RTOG 9804 trial, we required 3 millimeters of negative margin. However, I think the 2 millimeter margin from the ASTRO SSO guideline is appropriate. So I would say at least 2 millimeters, but know that it was 3 millimeters in the two clinical trials looking at observation for DCIS. The other question I was asked about DCIS by a couple of people was recurrence, which genomic marker I personally use. We actually use a DCIS recurrence score for patients who are undecided about what they want to observe if they have a low risk DCIS. And I think patients find it helpful. It really does give them a personal information about their prognosis for recurrence. We also, though, are participating in the registry for the Decision RT trial. So we're looking forward to learning more about that. So I'm pretty agnostic. I think you just have to figure out the clinical utility in your practice for using one of those scores. I then want to move on to the question of hypofractionation. Do I use it for patients who have implants for breast conservation? I do. We've had no issue with that. Do I use it for regional nodal irradiation? I'm going to be honest. We are participating in RT-CHARM, and so this is the Alliance trial that randomizes patients who are undergoing reconstruction within the next 7 months or who have a reconstruction to 42, 56, and 16 fractions for their chest wall regional nodal irradiation versus the standard 2 gray fractionation. We have been using it all along in older patients who are older than age 70, requiring post-mastectomy radiation or regional nodal. So I will be honest with that. We've done that as part of our practice continually. But in using it in younger women, we are participating in RT-CHARM. The one thing I'm getting a lot of questions on is how have I changed my breast cancer practice during the COVID-19 pandemic? And I wanted to briefly tell you that this is our institution's policies. I think everybody has to deliver their own depending on your practice pattern. For the most part, we are still seeing consults. We are doing CT sims. We are having all of our physicians take a look at the patient's records. If it looks like they're coming in very close to lumpectomy, we are backing that up. And it's really for hormone-sensitive, luminal A, node-negative patients, we're backing that up so that we will see them closer to 6 to 8 weeks, trying to get them going by 12 weeks. We normally try to get our patients started on radiation to 6 to 8 weeks. We're now backing that up a little bit for patients who are vulnerable. We're collaborating with our medical oncologists if they're hormone sensitive to start their endocrine therapy first and to back up even further initiation of CT scans. For triple negatives, though, HER2 positive, node positive patients, they're coming in as usual. We are doing telehealth follow-ups for our 4 to 6 week follow-ups or first off of RT follow-ups. And then trying to do as much, avoiding in-person follow-ups as much as possible. The other thing that we are doing and is making sure that we're wiping down every immobilization, the back bags, masks. All of our regional nodal radiation patients are masked. We make sure the masks are wiped down. And we're making sure we use a lot of DIBH and making sure our therapists, the therapists who are setting up the patient are not only gloved, but that for the fear of aerosolization with DIBH, we're making sure they're wearing both masks and eye shields. And then finally, I don't want to take up too much more time, but would say that the other questions that came in a lot was about 1 to 3 positive nodes. I do, as I said in the review, I think that the data supports that many, if not 1 to 3 positive nodes should be treated. In the adjuvant setting, we keep in mind in the MA20 trial, 58% of patients had just one positive node. So there's quite a bit of data supporting one positive node. Who do I consider not treating? I don't treat ITCs. I don't treat micrometastases. I think, you know, in an older patient who has one positive node and a T1B tumor, this is a patient that I think you have to use good judgment on in terms of what you think her risks are and whether she'll derive a benefit. The other thing that I don't treat, I do not treat T3N0s, I certainly don't treat as well. I would like to just quickly say that we only use pre-op radiation on clinical trial, and at least during COVID-19 pandemic, we've really suspended all enrollment, so we're not treating anybody right now in clinical trial or enrolling. And then I think what I'm going to do is switch this over to lymphoma. The lymphoma questions, I don't know if you want to choose, Yolanda, which ones to check, but I can tell you one of the things that seems most common question is, when do you use emergent radiation therapy when you're treating patients? Are there cases like cord compression or respiratory distress where you would begin with radiation therapy across Hodgkin's or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma?
Thank you. So it's a great question. So in general, if patients have symptoms that are not life-threatening, such as cord compression, we generally start upfront with chemotherapy. But if they are having neurologic symptoms, sometimes we will use radiation as a bridge to chemotherapy, and we'll give two or three fractions, for example, 3 grays each. So we're not going to definitive doses, but it's just to temporize the symptoms while patients are getting ready for systemic treatment.
The other question that came in quite commonly in the lymphoma section is the collective sense that you're trying to omit radiation therapy across lymphomas, and interpretations of many of the trials seem to stress omission of radiation therapy. Can you just talk about how you address that and what advice you give to particularly, you know, who are not in a dedicated lymphoma practice like yours advice you would say for how you manage that?
So that is a general impression that is seen in both community and unfortunately academic practices as well. And so how I've kind of addressed this is a gentle re-education of our medical oncologists at tumor boards. So much of the data that they are extrapolating from are from patients treated, which I had discussed in my review, in the extended field era where we were treating beyond obviously the gross nodal disease. And so those secondary cancers and cardiac toxicities, many of which were associated with death, is kind of what is imprinted on our medical oncologist mind. So I re-educate them that the concept now of using smaller fields means that we can't necessarily use that same data because the toxicity profile is going to be very individualized for a particular patient. The other aspect is that I educate them that we're using lower doses and having more advanced techniques. The other thing that I have found, which I've gotten very positive feedback from my medical oncologist, is that as part of the under-treatment note, I always attach a screenshot of what I've treated. The idea being that if we don't treat that particular organ at risk, they're not at that risk of toxicity. So I think a lot of this is re-educating of what modern radiation means for lymphoma patients, and that we can't leave on the table that there's going to be a decrement in progression-free survival if we omit radiation.
Terrific. Another question that's come in general, how do you manage, differently or modify dose for patients who did not receive their full planned systemic therapy?
It's a good question. It depends on the indication for radiation. So if patients have early stage, for example, DLBCL with no other risk factors, and they only get 3 cycles, I wouldn't modify it. I would usually go to 30 gray in setting of a complete response. If, however, there are additional risk factors such as bulk or skeletal involvement, and for example, they weren't able to tolerate the full course of 6 cycles of R-CHOP chemotherapy, I will modify my dose. So even in the setting of a complete response, I might go a little bit higher, for example, to 36 grays.
Okay, thank you very much. We have a few questions about very specific cases. I don't know if you would mind answering, and then we'll move on to palliative care. And if we have some time at the end, we'll go back to breast because there's a few more questions there. I just wanted to make sure we got all the questions addressed. So what would be your approach for a for like primary CNS lymphoma? What dose fraction volumes are used, and how long do you wait after IV methotrexate before beginning cranial radiation?
So that's an excellent question. So in the setting of a complete response, so this is based on MRI, there is data suggesting we could use what's called low-dose whole brain radiation. So that dose is 23.4 to 24 gray and 1.8 to 2 gray fractions. This is based on a phase 2 study. And, you know, I do extrapolate from that study because the induction regimens, which generally include high-dose methotrexate, are there's many different high-dose methotrexate regimens. But in general, I've been using this low-dose whole brain radiation as in that phase 2 study. The rates of neurocognition are actually lower than historical control. The fields are very typical for whole brain. I use the C2 as my inferior border. And it's important to make sure patients have had an ophthalmic exam, because if they have had ocular involvement, the whole orbit should be treated. Otherwise, you should be treating the posterior one-third to two-thirds of the orbit.
Terrific, thank you. And so another question that's come in is, for following excisional biopsy for stage 1 follicular lymphoma, how do you approach contouring the GTV for definitive radiation therapy?
So if all the GTV has been removed, there won't be a GTV as part of treatment planning. I will still use the CTV and then use treat that regional, those regional lymph nodes, since we are not using chemotherapy for subclinical disease.
Okay. And then just come again, very specific questions. A 26-year-old with classic Hodgkin's, 2A classic Hodgkin's lymphoma unfavorable, has relapsed after first ABVD cycle before second one. Again, this is a question for palliative radiation. Would you begin, is there a role for radiation in terms of symptoms relief, or would you wait until the response for more chemotherapy?
So that's a great question. So I'm assuming if the patient had symptoms and then they were starting chemotherapy, I would wait for response from chemotherapy. It can take several days, but generally the response rates are quite good. If the patient had a response with chemotherapy and now presumably because of new symptoms that are worrisome for progressive disease, generally these patients, you know, we will take them along the paradigm to salvage chemotherapy and stem cell transplant. The medical oncologist will try to biopsy these patients just to make sure that there's no other concurrent histology that we're missing as part of the diagnosis. Very rarely, and I don't think I've ever had to radiate patients kind of as bridge to the next systemic therapy.
Okay. The other question that has come in, I'm sorry, I lost my connection on Zoom, but I still am on the phone, is for peripheral cutaneous anaplastic large cell lymphoma with subsequent local recurrences out of field after 24 to 30 gray. How would you manage definitive radiation therapy? Would you give definitive radiation? Would you observe?
All right. So great question. So for primary cutaneous anaplastic large cell lymphoma, these are indolent cutaneous lymphomas. I think in terms of subsequent relapses outside the radiation field, I would kind of use the time to relapse as a guide to treat. So if it's a single relapse with a long remission time, I could consider a definitive dose for these patients. If the time to relapse was fairly short and there's multiple lesions, you know, a more palliative approach would be probably appropriate, and or consideration of systemic therapy.
Okay, terrific. I think what we're going to do is just move over to palliative care for questions as at this time. I'm keeping going back and looking at questions, so please, when you can. Probably, again, thank you for a great lecture. And then one question that's gotten the most hits is, what is a good source for dose constraints for palliation, since normal dose constraints are usually based on definitive radiation therapy? Hello?
I'm back. Okay. Am I able to be heard?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. So that's a really great question. There is no really good cohesive guideline for palliative doses. Usually in palliative radiation, we're using lower doses than we're using in definitive treatment. The challenge arises when we're doing re-RT, and really, you know, what I have used is usually literature that's been published from various studies that are, you know, that sort of are re-RT related to the area of the body that I'm going to be treating. So for instance, like the re-RT literature for brain, or the re-RT literature for spine. And I really try to just push the dose to the GTV as much as I can, but I always prioritize the normal tissue first. So if I'm not able to get in palliation, if I'm not able to get you know, the dose that I really want to a GTV, because the trade-off is the normal tissue, I will always spare the normal tissue first. Sometimes it's a little bit different in curative intent situations, but in palliative intent situations, I will always spare the normal tissue first. I don't know if that helps at all, but that's sort of the guideline that I use in my mind.
Okay, and I unfortunately have lost my connection again. So I don't know if one of the other presenters has a moderator question in front of them. If they're with me, I'm going to get the questions back up.
So I have the question here. One question is, is it your practice to initiate palliative care at the time of consultation with oncology patients? And if so, what proportion of patients eventually get enrolled into palliative care?
Yeah, so when I see a patient for an initial consultation or for a subsequent consultation for palliative RT, I usually do a fairly comprehensive assessment with them, in addition to the usual H&P and issues that we typically think about, imaging, reviewing imaging, et cetera, for deciding, you know, what and how to treat in terms of radiation. I will also do a palliative care assessment. I will usually ask about, the living situation, how patients are, able to do their daily activities. What are their limitations? What do they know about their illness? Sort of what is their illness understanding? What are their fears for the, you know, for the future? What do they know? Sometimes I will also be, you know, sometimes it's hard to go over all this stuff in the initial consultation, but over the course of then the treatment, I will often conversations will unfold regarding prognosis. Especially I noticed that towards the end of treatment, when people are usually wondering what happens next and they're looking more towards the future. And at that time, because there's just a lot of stuff that happens in the beginning of a treatment course, it's really oftentimes during on treatment visits or towards the end of treatment that I will see what their symptom burden is really like right at that moment. Oftentimes they may have symptoms from the radiation that I've given them, especially for something like whole brain. And at that point, I will have a very specific set of symptoms or reasons that they may benefit from palliative care, at which point I will... discuss with the referring physician what I have noticed, and we'll ask if that is something that would be okay with them if the patient goes to see palliative care for a specialty referral, because there may be issues that require specialty level palliative care at that point that I have identified because I have had the opportunity to see that patient through a course of treatment. I'll often never initiate a referral to palliative care by myself. It's always in line with the person who referred the patient to me and the other doctors who are involved with the patient care at that time.
Thank you. And then can you comment on Just, I think the question, a couple questions here on palliative bone met regimens. When you use 8 gray times 1, 20 gray times 5, 30 gray times 10, as you know, the many out there, just your kind of personal.
Sure. Sure. So there's quite a lot of literature on bone met radiation, which I specifically decided against teaching in my lecture because I feel like it's talked about a lot and there are lots of good references on it. In general, I think the oldest and most widely quoted randomized trial, the RTOG study of 8 gray times 1 versus 3 gray times 10 from the late 90s, demonstrated that there's really no difference in efficacy in terms of pain management up to 3 months after the treatments were given. So the question is, after that, what happens? Are there, higher retreatment rates in the 8 gray times 1 arm? Sure, there were. There are probably a lot of reasons for why that was that weren't well explained in the studies that have been published to date. Following that more recently, there was a study on actually patients who had malignant spinal cord compression, whether they could even receive 8 gray times 1, would that be sufficient for the control of their functional abilities? And, it may be a surprise to some people, but that the SCORAD study that was published very recently in JAMA, I believe, and that showed that 8 gray times 1 versus 4 gray times 5 was not inferior in terms of patients' ambulatory status and functional outcomes overall at about 8 weeks. So question really becomes sort of how much durability does one need? And this goes back to the initial part of my lecture, where the question is, how long do we need this treatment to work? And sometimes, prognosis discussions either between myself and the referring physician come up, and we have to align on something before, I use that in my treatment decision-making for the patient. And then there's discussion about that for the patient. In general, if I have a patient where I'm really pretty sure that the prognosis is on the shorter end of the spectrum, I'll use the shorter courses of fractionation because I'm really aiming for palliation and not really aiming for disease control at that point. If I'm a little questionable about the prognosis and I believe the patient may have other systemic options that are viable, that they may have a reasonable chance of having a response with them, and they're otherwise they have really, their ECOG 0 or 1, and they're outpatients, and I will give them. I always give those patients the benefit of the doubt, and I will give them, unless there's some reason that they cannot come in for multiple treatments, I'll usually give them longer courses of treatment, or I will try hard to be able to give SBRT or SRS to those patients. So I usually use the prognosis as a starting point for a guide. If the prognosis is shorter, then I will definitely try to err on the side of giving shorter treatments, and if it's longer, then I will err on the side of giving more disease control and durability with longer treatment.
All right, thank you. If it's okay with you too, I think for the last few minutes here, I'm going to go back to breast because there were a lot of questions that came in. But thank you both for your great comments. So other questions that came in during about the breast was really how to manage in the post-neoadjuvant chemotherapy. What do I do, for instance, in clinical N1 that gets reduced down to a pathologically node negative by chemotherapy? That, of course, as you may know, is the subject of our big clinical trial, NSABP B51 RTOG 1304, which we're almost done with, and I want to thank everybody who contributed patients. I personally, at this time, I have to say, I do believe the data that regional nodal radiation benefits most women who have a positive nodes. So who wouldn't I treat post-neoadjuvant chemotherapy who was positive before? Again, it would be basically talking to the patient about what trade-offs are important to her. So again, a luminal patient, who has a little bit of disease left in the breast, and there was a very small disease burden up front, and she's an older patient, we would talk about the trade-offs, because remember, every benefit we get has a trade-off in terms of particularly lymphedema risk and skin change risk. So that would be one group I wouldn't treat. But for the most part, if I, you know, if they're a patient who had enough positive nodes up front, I'm treating them post neoadjuvant chemotherapy until we get the data from B51-1304. There are a couple of questions about residual disease. What do you do in the setting of post neoadjuvant chemotherapy with residual disease? Do I treat that post mastectomy radiation therapy? And I would say enthusiastically, yes. Those are the patients that really have a high risk. And so I would treat them with their chest wall and their regional nodes in every case. I also want to address regional nodal radiation, and that I do believe that it includes the retained axil, what didn't come out already, the supraclavicular, and then the internal mammary nodes. I don't feel like we can pick and choose which nodes to leave out. I think it's more about what I can treat safely. So I target, if I've made a decision to treat regional nodal radiation, I do target the internal mammary nodes every time. When would I not target them? Well, when I can't get a heart dose safely down. So if it's a lower risk patient, an N1 patient, and I can't include my three intercostal spaces, I will then, you know, I will then maybe just do two intercostal spaces, but I'll respect my heart dose under that, the premise of, you know, first do no harm. When would I, for instance, accept a little higher heart dose? When, if I have a patient who presented with an internal mammary node and she didn't get it, it's not resected, and I am going to boost that up a little bit higher dose afterwards. So after I give my 50 gray, if I'm treating someone under 70, I'm going to use standard fractionation still. I'm going to boost the dose to the internal mammary node higher that was not resected. Then I would definitely use my full mean dose of 4 gray. And if in some cases I've gone as high as a mean dose of 5 gray in order to get the dose to high risk patients. So I treat the internal mammary nodes, and what makes me decide to limit it is really safety, cardiac dose. I've been asked a lot of questions in here about when I use internal mammary, IMRT for radiation therapy. We don't use it for intact breast, or we sometimes will use it for APBI, but pretty rarely. We really use 3D CRT for all of that. We treat prone for a lot of our intact breasts. For IMRT for regional nodal, we start every patient, and this is really a pathway born out of necessity because of insurance. So we start every patient on 3D CRT. If we can meet our constraints on that, with or without DIBH, we're good. And then if we can't, then we flip it over to IMRT. And generally, we can meet our constraints. But then we send the 3D CRT plan for approval as well. And that tends to be our ticket to approval if we can show that we didn't get our 3D CRT plan. We are coming down in the last couple minutes. I want to just pass the microphone back to my colleagues for them to make closing statements. Thank you very much. Stay your social distance and be healthy. Are you two on mute?
So thank you to the attendees for these excellent questions. I also welcome, if you ever needed to use it, or welcome to email me if you have any questions related to lymphoma as well.
Thank you, everyone. Me too. I'm always happy to receive emails and troubleshoot difficult cases with anyone as well.
And I would like to third that. Thank you for your attention today and being here. And please don't hesitate to email me. We try to give our best data here, but there's a lot of other information that sometimes can't fit into these talks, and we recognize that you might want that addressed. Thank you again to the ASTRO organizers for helping us flip over to virtual so we can continue to bring this refresher course, and please enjoy the rest of your virtual refresher course.